Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, another school shooting leaves three children and three adults dead, this time at a private school in Nashville, Tennessee.
How is this still happening? How are our children still dying, and why are we failing them?
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delays plans to overhaul the nation's court system amid widespread protests.
And a new poll reveals what Americans think of the former president's legal troubles and highlights a sharp divide between Donald Trump's base and other voters. Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. As we come on the air, we're tracking developments in two major stories. Americans witnessing the horror of another mass shooting, a deadly assault on a school. And Israelis witnessing a day unlike any before it, an upheaval that paralyzed the country.
First to the attack in Tennessee's capital city that left the shooter and six people dead, including three children at a church-run school. The police chief said he was moved to tears by the tragedy. Stephanie Tsai begins our coverage.
In a scene that has become all too familiar in this country, first responders in Nashville, Tennessee this morning rushed to respond to reports of an active school shooter. This time at the Covenant School, a private Christian elementary school of about 200 students. Tennessee police initially said a female suspect entered the school and killed three children and three staff members before being shot and killed by responding officers. The children were identified as Evelyn Dickhouse, Hallie Scruggs, and William Kinney. And the adult victims, all in their 60s, were named Cynthia Peek, Catherine Kuntz, and Mike Hill. The shooter was later identified as Audrey Hale, transgender, 28 years old, and a former student at the school. Don Aaron with the Nashville Police Department described the weapons used.
We know that she was armed with at least two assault-type rifles and a handgun. She entered the school through a side entrance and traversed her way from the first floor to the second floor, firing multiple shots.
Nashville police say it took less than 15 minutes from the first emergency call to when police officers stopped the shooter. Nashville Police Chief John Drake described the goal of their response.
I hope that we would never have this situation, that if we ever did, we would not wait. We would immediately go in and we would immediately engage the person perpetrating this horrible crime.
Shortly after the shooting, first responders escorted the surviving students from the Covenant School to buses where they were reunited with their families who were gathered at a nearby church. Today at the White House, President Biden called for more action.
We have to do more to stop gun violence. It's ripping our communities apart, ripping the soul of this nation, ripping at the very soul of the nation. And we have to do more to protect our schools so they aren't turned into prisons. So I call on Congress again to pass my assault weapons ban. It's about time that we begin to make some more progress.
74 people have either died or been wounded by shootings on K through 12 campuses since the start of the year. And last year, 273 people were injured or killed in school shootings, the highest on record. Last year, gun violence overtook car accidents as the leading cause of death for children in the United States. Ashby Beasley and her then six-year-old son survived the Highland Park shooting in Chicago last 4th of July and happened to be in Nashville on a family vacation. She attended the police briefing.
I have met with over 130 lawmakers. How is this still happening? How are our children still dying, and why are we failing them?
Those are questions that many Americans are asking as well. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Police also said that two of the three weapons used appeared to have been obtained legally. To help us understand more about what transpired today, we turn to Jillian Peterson, the co-founder of The Violence Project. That's a nonprofit dedicated to data-driven violence prevention. She's also an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thank you for being with us. The terror of gun violence once again visited upon what are supposed to be places of refuge. A school on church grounds. Jillian, what about this case stands out to you?
You know, there's a number of things that actually stand out to me about this case. The first being that it was an elementary school. Those are rare. And also a small private elementary school. We tend to see school mass shootings at large, typically suburban public high schools. And so this is unique in terms of the location. And what's coming out about the perpetrator, some of the facts seem unique as well. The fact that the perpetrator identified as transgender is unique in our database, where we look at just K through 12 school mass shooters who killed four or more people at school. They are 100% identify as male.
Police say the shooter was armed with two assault-type rifles and a handgun. President Biden, as we saw in Stephanie's report today, is reviving his push for a federal assault ban, a federal assault rifle ban in the aftermath of this tragedy. How often are assault weapons used in mass shootings?
That number has been increasing, actually. So the most common gun used is still a handgun. When it comes to K through 12 school shootings, shooters tend to use handguns oftentimes because they are students of the school and they're not old enough to purchase guns. So they're stealing guns from home, from their parents or grandparents. However, we've seen a real marked increase in the number of perpetrators using those AR-15 style assault weapons, particularly in the past sort of 3 to 4 years. Those numbers have just skyrocketed.
There have been more than 100 mass shootings this year so far, a disturbing milestone that really highlights the uniquely American problem with gun violence. School shootings are also on the rise. You have led large-scale research studies on preventing gun violence. What more needs to be done?
Yeah, with our research, we coded about 200 perpetrators on nearly 200 different life history variables. We talked to perpetrators, we talked to people who knew them and tried to understand what is that pathway to violence and what does it look like. And in our book called The Violence Project, we identified over 30 different prevention strategies that we could be using. Things like suicide prevention, because so many of these are suicides, crisis intervention teams, anonymous reporting systems, and then anything that makes it harder for somebody who is in a crisis, who is at risk of hurting themselves or someone else, anything we can do to make it harder for them to get their hands on a gun.
Tennessee recently enacted a law allowing most people over the age of 21 to conceal carry. And Tennessee is not alone. In fact, now half of America's 50 states now allow people to carry guns without first seeking a permit. In your research, is there any connection between the passage of these kinds of laws and an increase in gun violence?
You know, that law in particular is actually very difficult to study. And in general, mass shootings, while they are happening with alarming frequency, they're still relatively rare events. So it's hard to know when different laws get passed kind of what contributed and why, research-wise. What we do know is that it is very easy for people who are in crisis, who are telling people that they are thinking about violence, who are wanting to die themselves, it is very easy for them to get their hands on a firearm legally in this country. And we know that that is having a contributing effect.
What will you be watching for as this investigation continues?
You know, it's always, there's always a discussion of motive. Perpetrators typically target something that represents their grievance with the world, that represents their anger. Oftentimes they want to get a message out to the world to show people their anger and to be known for doing this. So we'll see if a manifesto comes out or more information emerges about motive. And then it's always really important to look at what were the warning signs leading up to this. Did this person tell other people? Did the perpetrator leak their plans? Were they in a known crisis? Is there something we can learn from this shooting that would allow us to prevent the next one?
Jillian Peterson. Jillian, thank you for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, our other lead story, unprecedented upheaval in Israel. After weeks of protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his fragile far-right coalition, this evening, Netanyahu said he would delay but not cancel proposed changes to take power from the judiciary. His supporters say the legislation would rein in an out-of-control bench. Opponents call it a fundamental attack on Israeli democracy. Special correspondent Nurit Ben is in Jerusalem for us tonight.
3 months into historic mass protests across the country that have rocked the nation to its core, scrambled its economy and military and widened a deepening rift in Israeli society. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced tonight a temporary pause to his proposed judicial overhaul at the heart of it.
From a national responsibility, from the will to avoid the rift within the people, I decided to suspend the second and third reading from the law in this Knesset tenure in order to give time to get to a broad consensus to pass the legislation during the next Knesset.
His primetime statement came after a 10-hour delay, locked in negotiations with far-right members of his coalition. The result, a deal not likely to satisfy all opponents of the overhaul. Legislation will be paused until the next Knesset session in early May. In exchange, a green light for far-right party leader and Minister of Internal Security Itamar Ben-Gvir to form a civil National Guard. Leading up to it all today, a thunderous sound of chants, horns, and drums filling Israeli cities across the country for the 13th week in a row. Protesters making their way to Jerusalem, where over 100,000 people gathered outside the Supreme Court and Parliament.
We won't let our judicial system be trampled on. We care about our judicial system and the fact that it has no political agenda, neither left or no right.
And an unprecedented general strike since called off. The head of Israel's largest labor union, side by side with top private sector leaders, announcing a shutdown, planes grounded, schools and universities closed. It all came hours after a chaotic night across the country. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis quite literally leaving their beds to join unplanned protests. After Netanyahu fired his defense minister for calling to pause the legislation. That decision to oust him couldn't have come at a more sensitive time, when hundreds of reservists have withdrawn from military duty in protest of the overhaul. Steps from the Supreme Court in Jerusalem, the anger and energy was palpable.
I've been living here for 25 years. I came from London, from a good democracy to a good democracy. Israel, it feels like it's been hijacked by a group of extremists trying to derail this country.
I'm here for my children. Two of them are soldiers. My grandparents came from Romania after the Holocaust, and they built the country, and I'm here for them also.
It's tough to overstate just what a decisive moment this really is for Israel's future as a country, for its society, its security, its economy. The masses of protesters here in Jerusalem and across the country say they're fighting for no less than democracy itself, just before what they fear will be the point of no return.
It's a moment where the pilots and the doctors and the high-tech entrepreneurs and the students on the campuses and the small business owners and the nurses and everyone are coming out and saying, you will not derail our democracy.
Tonight, the collision course between sectors of Israeli society may just begin to slow down, but the weeks ahead will reveal if a true new path forward can be found, or if it's just a moment of calm before the next storm. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nurit Ben in Jerusalem.
In the day's other headlines, the death toll confirmed from Friday's powerful tornado in Mississippi was revised down to 21 from 25. That word came as volunteers and aid poured into the hard-hit Delta Flatlands. Drone footage showed two small towns all but leveled. Officials say the twister damaged or destroyed more than 1,600 homes and that a full recovery could take years. In Ukraine, the head of the UN Nuclear Agency warned again that Europe's largest nuclear power plant is under threat. Rafael Grossi told President Volodymyr Zelensky that conditions at the Zaporizhzhia site are not improving. It's held by the Russians and has suffered repeated blackouts. Meantime, Germany confirmed that 18 of its Leopard 2 battle tanks plus other armored vehicles have now arrived in Ukraine. Trains, planes, and public transit in Germany stood still today as labor unions called a one-day strike for higher pay. It was the latest major labor protest across Europe as inflation hits workers hard. In Munich, thousands of flights were canceled at the airport, where check-in counters were empty. Train stations were also ghost towns.
Jetzt gerade könnte ich ehrlich gesagt einfach nur heulen, weil es einfach nur...
Right now, I could honestly just cry because I'm just terribly upset by it. I mean, I understand this, and it's good to be on strike, but I've had a lot of really bad luck lately because of the strikes. And of course, that really sucks.
The 24-hour strike also shut down Germany's ports. A U.S. aircraft carrier and its battle group began naval exercises today with South Korean warships. The joint maneuvers included air defense and other drills. They opened hours after North Korea fired two more short-range missiles into the sea, the seventh test this month. Back in this country, Silicon Valley Bank has a new owner after its collapse sent ripples across the financial sector. First Citizens, based in North Carolina, will buy SVB's deposits and loans. It'll also share the failed bank's other assets with the FDIC. And on Wall Street, the buyout of Silicon Valley Bank helped bank stocks in general. As for the broader market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 194 points to close at 32,432. The NASDAQ fell 55 points. The S&P 500 added 6. Still to come on the News Hour, a new poll highlights a sharp divide between Donald Trump's base and other voters. Comedian Margaret Cho talks about her career and the role of comedy today. And March Madness lives up to its name with a very unexpected Final Four in the men's tournament.
This is the PBS News Hour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We return now to the political turmoil in Israel and what by many accounts is an existential moment for the nation. Has the crisis created by Prime Minister Netanyahu's government been averted or just postponed? And what is the state of the now 75-year-old democracy? Ambassador Daniel Shapiro was the American envoy to Israel during the Obama administration. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Ambassador Shapiro, welcome and thanks for joining us. Netanyahu's plan to overhaul the judiciary set off one of the deepest domestic crises in Israel's history. Does the decision to delay that plan end the crisis?
It does not end the crisis. It does buy some time. The last 12 weeks in Israel have been utterly dominated by this issue. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis have come into the streets to protest against it. It was the source of nearly all news coverage. Heading into what is normally a very happy time of year with Passover holiday, then the Day of Independence, the Israelis celebrate with a lot of unity. The country was riven as it's rarely been in its history. So the announcement today that the Prime Minister is postponing work on this legislative package certainly buys time. People are exhaling. People are going to enjoy the holidays. But he has said he's going to come back to the issue again when the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, resumes session in May. And by the end of that session in July, he intends to pass a version of it. He has said he wants to engage in dialogue and seek a more consensual type of overhaul of the judiciary, something that would gain the support of some of the opposition parties. But he has also said that if that dialogue doesn't produce consensus, he's prepared to go back to his fairly narrow coalition and ram through the same package that he just put on the back burner. So the crisis is not over, but some time has been bought, and at least there's a pathway to try to get to a more peaceful outcome.
Why do you think he took this approach at this moment? Given the political landscape, given how dependent he is on his coalition, did he have any other option right now?
He really is quite dependent on some parties in this coalition who are deeply hostile to the Supreme Court and badly want to weaken it for different reasons, some because of the court's positions on West Bank settlements, some because of the court's positions on military exemptions for religious students. And so because that's the coalition he has and the only one that can keep him in power, he's worked hard to deliver for them. At the same time, he saw, as we all did, the incredible outpouring of opposition. And clearly, most polls in Israel showed that more than 50% of the country was not comfortable, felt that this was an overreach that would so weaken the Supreme Court that there would be no check and balance on the government's power and decisions it might make or laws it might pass. Then what really was the tipping point was yesterday when his own defense minister from his own party, even a supporter of the judicial overhaul, said this is not the time and this is not the way to pass it. And the reason was that it's posing a risk to Israel's security. Security is really the coin of the realm in Israel. And Israelis took that warning seriously, but Prime Minister Netanyahu was so troubled by the lack of support from his own defense minister that he fired him. And that produced this spontaneous explosion of protests at even a higher level of intensity and emotion than we've seen before. And it so spooked members of his own party that they came to him overnight and said, Mr. Prime Minister, we really can't push this through now. We need a pause. And that was why I think he ultimately felt he had today to take this decision.
That fired defense minister said today that he welcomed the delay, as did the head of the main labor union there, who called off the general strike that had been declared this morning. But the protests do continue tonight. And there are some organizers who are also saying there will be another mass protest in Tel Aviv. Do you see any way in which those protesters go home? They don't continue these protests unless the plan is completely pulled.
I think there will be a break. I hope people will allow themselves to exhale and break over holidays. But that doesn't mean this issue is over. It won't surprise me if on Saturday night, the usual protest night, there is a large protest because people feel that it's precisely because they rallied that they prevented something very dangerous from happening that could have done great damage to Israel's democracy, Israel's economy, Israel's security. And so they don't want to give up that energy and they don't want to let down their guard. Probably after the holidays, when the Knesset resumes and they start again trying to see if there's a way to pass this, these protests will still be there. And many of the citizens who feel that they put their selves, their bodies, their time on the line to defend Israeli democracy will be back out there. Israelis care very deeply about the fact that Israel has not known a day of its 75-year history, that it was not a democracy, never missed an election, and the idea that some of those features of Israel's democratic character could be put at risk, I think will bring people back to the streets if they feel it is once again put at risk.
Ambassador Shapiro, what position does this put U.S. and White House officials in? We saw them today say they welcome this delay. This gives people time and space. They urged Israeli leaders to work towards compromise and noted that the hallmark of the U.S.-Israel relationship has been democratic principles. When you look at this plan to overhaul the judiciary, is that consistent with democratic principles?
Well, I think President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken have made pretty clear that they had some concerns about it. They did it somewhat gently and somewhat broadly in public. I think they were more direct and more specific in private, including in the president's recent phone call with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And the president is a great believer in Israel, its legitimacy, its security, the U.S.-Israel relationship. He cares very deeply about it, but he has always said that what really is the fundamental core of it is the common values of the two democratic countries. And if at some point Israel were on a path that would take away some of those features of checks and balances, of rule of law, of separation of powers, and if it were to ram through changes to a system of government that don't embody consensus or some transparency or taking the time to have the discussion that allows people to accept these changes and allows them to be enduring, that would cause damage to Israel's democratic character, but ultimately that could cause damage to this partnership that both countries derive a great deal of benefit from. So he made that point. He made it very, very clearly. I think he's quite relieved by the decision to postpone the legislation today. But I'm sure the president would be willing to come back and make those points again, even more directly if necessary, if that's the situation in June and July.
That is Daniel Shapiro, former American envoy to Israel and now distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Democratic lawmakers are calling out former President Donald Trump for insightful rhetoric against federal officials and prosecutors. And new polling shows Mr. Trump is losing support among swing voters. Lisa Desjardins has more on what this means for his bid for the Republican presidential nomination.
Good morning, everyone.
In New York City, strong words and pushback at former local and former president Donald Trump.
You're not bringing that insurrection here, Donald Trump.
A group of Democratic lawmakers and community activists this morning defending the city's top prosecutor. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg heads an investigation that could lead to charges against Trump. Late last week, Trump warned on his Truth Social platform that charges could mean, quote, death and destruction. And in a post that was later deleted, the former president shared an image of himself with a baseball bat next to Bragg. Since then, Bragg received death threats, including an envelope with white powder in it. New York Congressman Adriano Espaillat.
We will not be intimidated as a community by threats, and we're here to watch our DA's back.
It's a big hello to Texas.
But in Texas over the weekend,
it's great to be back.
Trump supporters crowded by the thousands to support him as he railed against Bragg and anyone investigating him.
From the beginning, it's been one witch hunt and phony investigation after another.
Trump, never shy from controversy, stirred more with this first campaign rally of his 2024 run, simply with the location, Waco. In 1993, the nation watched as a standoff in Waco between federal agents and a religious cult led to 86 deaths. The event has become a touchstone for some, including violent extremist groups. And the weeks-long siege happened exactly 30 years ago. During his speech, Trump seized on anti-government fears with vivid imagery referencing violence.
The only way to stop these arsonists is to rebuke and reject this evil persecution by sending us straight back to the White House.
The rally included a recording of the national anthem by people incarcerated for rioting on January 6th. Trump himself disparaged prosecutors and the Biden administration, telling supporters,
"You will be vindicated and proud, and the thugs and criminals who are corrupting our justice system will be defeated, discredited, and totally disgraced." That's what's
While
happening.
Trump continues to rile up his loyal base, happening. New polling shows he has convinced roughly 4 in 10 Americans he is the victim of a witch hunt. While the majority of those asked in the latest PBS NewsHour NPR Mayor's poll say investigations of Trump are fair. But that figure is much smaller, less than 1 in 5 for Republicans. There is also deep divide over his guilt or innocence. Nearly half of Americans say Trump has done something illegal. Less than a quarter say he's done nothing wrong at all. But that sentiment reverses for Republicans, with just 10% saying Trump's broken the law and nearly half believing Trump has committed no wrongdoing, legal or ethical. It adds up to a Trump grip on GOP loyalty. 3/4 of Republicans would like to see him be president again. But critical independent voters, nearly 2/3 of them, do not want him back, setting up a dilemma for the GOP.
For Donald Trump, it remains all about his base.
Lee Meringoff is the director of the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion.
So if you're going to be elected, you need to have your core intact, and it's largely intact for him. But you also need to get a good swipe of the independents. And that right now seems more in doubt because of the concerns over what he's going through right now in terms of the investigations and where that might play out.
But for the Trump supporters at his Waco rally, there's only one choice.
If Trump got arrested for the charges they're talking about now, I would vote for him 10 times over. I just don't believe there's anything to it. And even if there is, so what? You know, it's his own private life. So what?
Donald Trump is for America, and he fights for Americans. The far left doesn't like that, and so that's why they keep attacking him.
Supporters show few doubts, but a host of questions remain over Trump's legal and political future. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
Former President Trump's speech in Waco sparked concerns over the signal it sent to right-wing extremists and a base that continues to believe the 2020 election was stolen. Laura Barrón-López takes a deeper look at how the former president's 2024 message is dominated by extremist rhetoric.
Trump's anti-government rhetoric is part of a larger pattern by the former president and his allies to discredit and attack federal law enforcement and government institutions. Such threats could again result in violence, experts warn. Barbara F. Walter is a professor at UC San Diego and expert in violent extremism. And Adrienne LaFrance, the executive editor of The Atlantic, her latest piece, The New Anarchy, delves into the history of political violence in America. Barbara and Adrienne, thank you so much for joining us. Barbara, I want to start with you. Trump just held his first big 2024 rally in Waco, Texas. What's the significance of holding it there?
Oh, well, this is the 30-year anniversary of the big siege that happened there, which
which for many in the far right, especially those groups that are anti-federal government, they see this as the perfect example of government overreach, everything that's wrong with the federal government. And of course, Trump right now is facing an indictment by the federal government, which to him is the biggest threat to his future presidency, to his candidacy, to his life in some ways. So he is in a fight for his life, and the federal government is his enemy. Waco is the symbol to the far right of government overreach.
And Adrienne, in your piece titled New Anarchy, you explore years of political violence, some by militia groups in America and abroad, and you focus heavily on violent clashes in Portland in 2020. You report that were instigated by right-wing extremists. Do you think that those clashes in 2020 in Portland are a warning that that they could potentially happen on a larger scale nationally?
I think that when you talk to people in Portland, you hear some who would say that what happened there was really unique to Portland and not necessarily replicable. But when you look at it sort of broadly, the sense that right-wing extremists can find a city that may be left-leaning or disproportionately represented by left-leaning folks and go there and sort of draw them out into violence, which is what happened in Portland, certainly you could imagine that happening in other blue cities surrounded by red exurbs. And so I think more than that, though, it's less about replicating what happened in Portland and more just the sense that political violence is, by pretty much every measure, worsening in America, and paying attention to sort of how that trend line is going and what we should be doing about it.
And Barbara, talking about the potential ideologies that are underneath and what's pushing that political violence, Trump's rhetoric during his Waco speech was seen by some historians as a dog whistle to white nationalists.
We will build new monuments to our great American heroes. We won't tear them down. We'll build them up. Clean out homeless camps from our inner cities. Get rid of ugly buildings that are hurting those cities and other places, and return to the magnificent classical style of Western civilization. We will support baby bonuses, so many people like that, for the new baby boom that will be coming. We need babies.
Barbara, what's the message there, and who is that for?
The message is that America is a country of white Christians. And in fact, sometimes he'll go further. It's white male Christians. He will talk about how that is the America, that it's always been that way and should always be that way. When he talks about this baby boom, he is talking about white babies that need to be born in order to ensure that whites will remain a majority in this country, which as of today, they will not. The only way to prevent whites from becoming a minority in this country is for white people to have more babies, and that's what he's calling for.
Adrienne, your piece, as well as Barbara's work, talks about how rhetoric like that can lead to political violence, and you specifically explore political violence in Italy across the 70s and 80s, known as the Years of Lead. And then you also mention lynchings of black people in response to Reconstruction. One of your conclusions you write is, quote, sometimes violence ends not because it is overcome, but because it has achieved its goal. You appear to essentially be saying that some cataclysmic event, like an assassination of a politician, is what could ultimately end this political violence. Why?
Well, something I heard from people over and over in my reporting was that, in fact, we haven't yet reached a point that has led to enough Americans to take this problem seriously, and that perhaps, as horrific as it is to contemplate, that it'll take something worse. Some of the examples that came up were, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing, which was one of the horrific events that eventually sort of tamped down or at least pushed underground some of the militia movement of the 80s and the 1980s and 1990s. But again, I mean, we would never wish for such an event anyway. And there is some question of what sort of cataclysm would even quote unquote work, because you look at January 6th and after that event, you know, many people said, well, this certainly will bring the decent Republicans to their senses. They'll stand up and sort of right the ship and say what their party actually stands for and condemn violence. And, you know, that certainly hasn't happened. And so there's a real question as to what it might take to help the country come to its senses in this moment.
Barbara, on attacks on law enforcement officials and top officials, we've seen that Trump has been attacking in his Waco speech, as well as in recent days, has been attacking the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg. And some House Republicans have also been attacking the Manhattan District Attorney, saying that they're going to investigate him. This is the district attorney that's investigating the hush money payments during the 2016 campaign. And Bragg has been subject to death threats. Are you concerned that right now about the potential for political violence?
I'm actually feeling a bit optimistic right now, but this could change pretty quickly, and I'll tell you why. I'm optimistic because in the months and the weeks leading up to January 6, 2021, Trump was on Twitter aggressively tweeting. He had almost 90 million followers. He had this enormous bullhorn from which he could get his message out. He could foment anger. He could basically play to the fears and the anger that were out there with a subset of Americans. Today, he has only about 2 million active users of his own social media platform. That's a significantly smaller reach. Bullies and wannabe autocrats need a bullhorn. Big social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube provide a great tool for them. Trump hasn't had that. He doesn't have it right now. He hasn't been willing to move over to Twitter, for example, even though Elon Musk has allowed him to go back there. And he hasn't done that because he doesn't want to lose the revenue that he's getting from subscribers to his own platform. But he's going to realize that having this smaller reach is hurting him, and he's going to move over there. And when he moves over there, he suddenly is going to have his bullhorn back.
Adrian, you try to diagnose a solution potentially for the political violence in your piece. You say that the solution to avoid the constant violence is that Americans have to confront their underlying ideologies and confront where it first takes root, which is in the mind of citizens. How does that happen right now when across red states there's an effort to censor history, to censor Black history, to censor LGBTQ history?
So two things we see different today relative to the many other periods in American history where we've experienced political violence are the social web, as you just mentioned, and this incredible scale of these platforms where you can have extremist thoughts sort of spread in an instant. And the other is the success of the election denial movement. And I think addressing both of those things is crucial. And that requires the American people to really prioritize ending political violence and vote accordingly. I think that goes to your question as well about this active attempt in many states and among many leaders to suppress the teaching of history, for example, and to fight that as well.
Adrian LaFrance, Barbara Walter, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Margaret Cho is a trailblazer in the world of stand-up comedy and a bold, brash, and unapologetic voice on political and social matters. She's now celebrating 40 years of making people laugh and pay attention to the issues of the day. I met up with her recently at the Warner Theater in Washington, D.C. for our arts and culture series, Canvas. Live and Livid is the name of Margaret Cho's big first tour since the pandemic.
So you take your dog everywhere, huh?
Yeah, she's really special. She's
and her loyal Chihuahua mix rescue dog, Lucia, is along for the ride. At 54 and performing professionally since 16, Cho has woven comedy through her stand-up, acting, and even her LGBTQ activism.
We need to recognize that a government that would deny a gay man the right to bridal registry is a fascist state.
From stand-up specials like Notorious C.H.O. in 2002.
Her name is...
to Psycho in 2015. To starring in the groundbreaking 90s TV comedy All American Girl, inspired by her stand-up routines about the culture clashes between her traditional Korean mother and herself, a fully Americanized daughter.
Look,
He's a doctor. And from a good traditional family.
Wow, and check out that frequent flyer mileage.
To appearances such as her Emmy-nominated recurring role in 30 Rock, playing Kim Jong-il.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Finally, my girls have arrived!
And recently, a Hulu film, Fire Island, with Saturday Night Live's Bowen Yang. Cho knew from an early age growing up in San Francisco, comedy was her calling.
I just love the art form, and it was just a recognition more than anything that it was what I would grow up to be. I think a lot of people maybe have those feelings maybe when they were kind of playing, like as a kid, you're like, oh, I want to be a fireman, I want to be a lawyer. I think that I had those kinds of really childhood aspirations to be a comedian, but it was a very visceral knowledge of this is my job, oddly, because I was not a class clown.
Really? Yeah. So who were your early influences then? Who were you looking to say, I could do that, I want to do that?
Joan Rivers, ultimately, because she was so incredibly elegant, but also crass. She was finding a way to be crass, which is pretty incredible. In the 70s for women and in comedy and for television the way it was.
She was one of your mentors, and I saw where you said that some of the advice that she once gave you was, we are the type of girls who don't find our place when young. The funny ones, the odd ones, the weirdos, we are seen a little later.
She was very right about how we become more and more visible the older we get. And she would say to me, you know, we're like the girls that were ugly in high school. And I'm like, you know, watch your mouth. Watch your mouth. You know, it's a funny thing of like when you realize that we actually grow in value as we age. And it's a powerful thought, you know, that we can actually really embrace that power. So I think that she was very right about that.
Do you view your stand-up act as being part of your activism?
Yes, my stand-up comedy is the main channel for my activism. It's the way that I am an activist. If you go back to Bob Hope, that's all he was doing, was lending his sense of humor to the cause.
In fact, when I was a boy, I had such a high voice, the teacher made me sit with the girls.
Although my cause is somewhat different, but actually not really that different. It's about boosting morale. It's about sort of a call to action and call for unity for Americans.
To be clear, the language Cho uses is nothing like Bob Hope.
But sometimes you'll see like a really beautiful Asian woman and she's with the most f***ed up face, broke down, busted white man. And I'm just like, bitch, are your eyes that small?
Crass and vulgar are some of the words used to describe her humor. I asked her about that approach.
I think like what I've been trying to do is hit sort of both high and then low. So like high-minded is like looking towards fighting for equality, fighting for rights for the queer community, fighting for trans lives, fighting for drag, fighting for all of these things in a very noble effort, but then undercutting it with the most crass, explicit, foul joke that you can have that center, a very highly minded idea. So that my feeling like if like I'm trying to make this it's like a sundae or something, like you want the cherry on top to be a really noble effort, but underneath it's just filth.
And when you live together, sex takes on a whole new dimension. I feel like a prostitute that works for really low rates.
You have been really open about your past addiction, your past mental health issues. How does that journey show up in your work?
Well, I think it's important to talk about mental health as a subject matter because it's inherently really funny because it's like really like full of mystery and terrifying.
In what ways?
Well, it's like, to me, the closer that we are to death, the more that we can laugh in the face of that, the more strength that we have to carry on living.
Hmm.
And so the humor is really the coping mechanism of the spirit.
I never saw Asian people on television or in movies, so my dreams were somewhat limited. I would dream
Maybe someday I could be an extra on MASH.
When you were a child and you knew that this was the life that you wanted for yourself, did you ever allow yourself to think that it would be this big?
No, I never knew what it would be. I never thought about what my career would look like just because I didn't have any examples to draw from.
But Dancing with the Stars is old people's jam.
Her mom is often a foil for Cho's humor and a butt of her jokes, too.
Every taping, she would sit in the front row of the tapings, and I could not even look at her because she would emit this low-pitched moan that only I could hear.
You know, she's 88 now, and so this is a very, like, special time. You know, we usually treasure everything that she says, so that's a really big part of my work, is talking about her. And then everybody really loves, like, just to hear her voice through that. You know, whether that's like, because she thinks my haircut's, the haircut's a bit gay. So she thinks this haircut is the most gay that my hair has been, which is right. But that's a kind of voice is, like, I think the thing that people are familiar with, because it's sort of like talking about the immigrant experience, that is also when it becomes very right on.
You've been doing this, as you mentioned, for 40 years. What's your greatest accomplishment?
My greatest accomplishment is, I think, inspiring comedians like Joel Kim Booster and Bowen Yang to further greatness, you know, that they were able to see me and recognize that this is what they wanted to do. So yes, the reason that Ali Wong exists, the reason that Awkwafina is out there, all of these comedians, I think, were inspired by me, and that's my greatest achievement.
If there was ever an NCAA tournament that earned the name March Madness, this is it. Particularly on the men's side. For the first time, all four number one seeds failed to reach the Elite Eight or the Final Four. In fact, it's the first time since 1979 that a number one, two, or three seed failed to make it to the Final Four. No one expected the teams that remain: Miami, San Diego State, the University of Connecticut, and Florida Atlantic. The Florida Atlantic Owls never even won an NCAA tournament game before this run. Let's talk about the men's tournament so far and what might explain some of these results. Nicole Auerbach is a senior writer for The Athletic. She joins me now. Nicole, welcome. And the first thing I just have to ask you, out of curiosity, is how is your bracket doing? Because mine is terrible, but you do this for a living. How's it going?
Oh, it's going probably even worse than yours. I always like to pick a couple upsets, but I picked the wrong ones this year. I had no Final Four teams alive as of last weekend. So at that point, I just root for the underdog, just like most of America in this situation.
Help us understand what's going on this tournament. We saw a 16 seed knock off a number one seed. First time since 2018 that's happened, when Fairleigh Dickinson beat Purdue. It was in the first round. There's been a number of other upsets. What's going on? What explains this chaos?
It's a great question. And I think depending on which coaches or athletic directors you talk to, they'll come up with different answers. But we have seen a lot more double-digit seeds pulling off upsets. And we've now seen 315 seeds in recent years make it all the way to the Sweet 16. And you can look at the parity in the sport and look at the transfer portal. You're seeing a lot of player movement in men's college basketball, and one player makes such a big difference in this sport. You're seeing coaches turn over rosters when they make changes. So Jerome Tang at Kansas State only had two players this time last year and brought in everybody else that ultimately built an Elite Eight run. So it's part of that. You're having talent dispersed to more places because guys are not just going to sit on the bench. And maybe they're also going to move down a level or up a level or laterally. But it's creating some interesting teams in interesting places, as well as name, image, and likeness payments, creating maybe more opportunities at schools that are outside of the blue bloods, where you can have your value, you can put some money in your pocket, and maybe take a team to the NCAA tournament.
Tell me a little bit more about the NIL rules and how they've impacted the game, because I think there was a lot of questions around how that would change team makeups and how that could change a tournament in the end. Where have we seen that make a difference?
Well, the rich are getting richer in certain places, for sure. But if you're a hometown kid and there's a school closer to home that has some NIL opportunities, maybe you could be the biggest deal in town. We've also seen some of the programs that are still left, including Miami, be something of a poster child for NIL because they have a mega booster who really jumped into this space with both feet. And we know that there were deals made for the men's basketball team and for the women's basketball team. So you know that these players are being compensated for their NIL deals while also playing. And people worried that it was going to tear locker rooms apart. But we've seen with Miami, they've been able to get to their first Final Four even so.
So when you look at the teams in the Final Four now, you've got Florida Atlantic playing San Diego State, Miami playing UConn. What are you expecting from these games?
Well, anyone who says that they know how this is going to go is probably wrong. We have seen that repeatedly over and over the last couple of weeks. But I do think UConn will be the heavy favorite here. This is the one program of the four that has actually been to this stage before. And last time they made it to the Final Four, they won it all. They've been playing really, really well. They have been steamrolling their opponents throughout the tournament. But it's so hard to count out a team like an FAU or a San Diego State with the defense and the style of play that they play. They have presented unique matchup problems for each of their opponents so far. So I would say it's UConn's tournament to lose. But I've said that about a few different teams at different points throughout this tournament. So that means that chaos could still reign.
Nicole, big picture, when you take a step back and you look at how this tournament is unfolded, is the reign of the Blue Bloods teams, is that over?
Well, it's probably not because we had basically an all Blue Blood Final Four last year. So it's hard to say that one year is a trend or it's just an aberration. But I do think this tournament has reminded us why we love this tournament so much. We've seen the early round upsets, but you don't always get a team like a Florida Atlantic that gets all the way this far. They had never won an NCAA tournament game until a week and a half ago. And so to think about them on this stage, that's something that's unprecedented. And this is one of the collections of Final Fours, as you mentioned, without a 1, 2, or 3 seed. That's never happened. But the seed totals are also incredibly high, except for some of the years that we've seen the Butler and UConn make the Final Four before. You don't usually get this much chaos, but I think you can make an argument based on a 15 seed getting to a Sweet 16, a 16 beating a 1, and then so many of these thrillers, overtime games, just the quality of matchups that we've seen, that this is one of the greatest NCAA tournaments ever.
A lot of great games. They've been a lot of fun to watch. That is Nicole Auerbach, senior writer for The Athletic, joining us tonight. Nicole, good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And later this week, we'll have much more on the women's NCAA tournament, in which history was made last night. Caitlin Clark propelled Iowa to the Final Four with 41 points, 10 rebounds, and 12 assists, the first 40-point triple-double ever in any NCAA tournament game, men's or women's. The rest of the women's Final Four will be decided in tonight's games. Go Maryland. And join us again here tomorrow night when top financial officials are set to testify on Capitol Hill about what led to recent bank failures. That is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Have a great evening.